So dig a little more into this. So do you charge hourly, flat fee, both? So how do you sort of approach that?
That's some other Kool-Aid that I eventually drank, which was moving to flat fees. That had been recommended to me for years. And for the most part, we do flat fees. Now we do a flat fee initial consultation. Oftentimes that initial consultation gets credited back toward work that they do going forward. But, you know, a flat fee consultation, as well as then flat fee on estate planning documents, guardianships, probates, all of that. So we, you know, through lots of tracking and metrics, have been able to kind of determine what makes sense and have made our lives significantly easier by billing on flat fees, I would say.
Welcome to the Founding Partner Podcast. Join your host, Jonathan Hawkins, as we explore the fascinating stories of successful law firm founders. We'll uncover their beginnings, triumph over challenges, and practice growth. Whether you aspire to launch your own firm, have an entrepreneurial spirit, or are just curious about the legal business, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Founding Partner Podcast. I'm Jonathan Hawkins, your host, and today we've got a great guest, Heather Nadler. Heather is an elder law attorney in Georgia, but Heather, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your firm, how it looks nowadays, you know, number of lawyers, number of staff, number of offices, that kind of thing.
Sure. Great. Well, first, thank you for having me, Jonathan. Appreciate the opportunity to share anything that I have to offer to attorneys who are looking to make changes in their firm or grow their firm. So my name is Heather Nadler, and I am a certified elder law attorney. My firm is Nadler Biernath. We're located in Peachtree Corners. We practice elder and special needs law, which is kind of an estate planning practice with a twist. It's a lot of trusts, powers of attorney, wills, that sort of thing, like you would think of with an estate planning practice. But we have a particular focus on helping seniors determine their needs with regard to long-term care, and also helping families who are providing for a loved one with a disability. So I have been practicing since 2001. I've been doing elder and special needs law since 2003. The current iteration of our firm is Nadler Biernath, as I mentioned. It was founded in 2014 by myself and my late partner, Mark Biernath. I had started my own firm in 2013, and Mark and I knew of each other through the elder and special needs law community. It's a pretty small community in terms of areas of law, so we all kind of know each other. And Mark was interested in bringing on a partner, and so he approached me about that. And we worked through it and formed our partnership in 2014. Currently, we have myself and two other attorneys, both of whom are associates here, and we have six staff. We have a client intake specialist, an administrative assistant, two paralegals, a director of marketing, and a practice manager. So we're a party of nine over here now. So we're just one office location.
Yeah, we're going to dig into a lot of that. So let's talk about, you got one office. Do you require everybody to come in? I imagine some of your client base probably likes to come in and meet with you in person. Do you have a hybrid? Tell us about that.
Well, we have one employee in particular who is very virtual, from El Salvador. So she is a virtual assistant that we hired through Get Staffed Up. That was a recommendation that was made to me. I talked to a bunch of colleagues on that, was hesitant about it, but eventually made the jump. And so she is a full-time virtual employee. We also, one of our paralegals is virtual. You know, a lot of the nature of our business is a lot of drafting and things that happen behind the scenes and are very amenable to being handled virtually. So she's a virtual drafter. For the most part, it just sort of seems like pretty much everybody except me works from home on Fridays. Friday is an intentional no client, no meetings kind of day. So it started out as, okay, yeah, just come on in and wear whatever you want. And then people decided they wanted to work from home. We've got some who live not too far away, but, you know, downtown, and so not convenient. So I definitely think it's worthwhile for folks to work from home when they want to. One of our associates works from home another day a week. One associate has a young child, just a year old. And so she's, you know, working from home more. So it's definitely a hybrid model. We do see clients, we offer clients the opportunity when they meet with us, if they would like to meet virtually or in person. I'd say a little more want to do in person than virtual. Maybe it's a 60-40 split or something. And that's probably a lot of the nature of our clientele, our seniors, whereas a lot of the younger clients might prefer a virtual meeting. But we do have, you know, everybody in, but certainly the flexibility of working from home, and we have everything, you know, set up where that's an easy possibility to make that happen when people want to or have germs we don't want in the office.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the VA from El Salvador. So, you know, a lot of folks talk about getting people from Philippines. I know that's a big area, and I think more and more people are going to South Central America. And that is something I think a lot of people are interested in and maybe are nervous to take the leap. Tell us about your experience. How long have you had that, and what do you use the person for, and how's it going?
So only since December. So it's only been a couple of months that she has been with us. One thing that I was, that was mentioned to me as I was deciding whether to do this or not, it was recommended to go with someone in Central America because of the time difference. You know, it's more difficult to work with someone who's on a very difficult, different time trajectory, like in the Philippines. But that's kind of the nature. I guess that just depends on whether you want real time help or not. I definitely wanted real time. So one of the things, she is technically working predominantly just for me, kind of to be my right hand and doing things that are easily done virtually. She's in my email. She manages my email, looks at it, flags things that need a response from me, makes me a list of the things that she's flagged that need a response from me, very much keeping me on track with things, which is wonderful. And then also she will, you know, do scheduling. She confirms appointments, sends out intake letters and intake forms once our client intake specialist schedules those appointments. So we really work on obviously keeping her busy in that way. And she's been great as far as responsiveness, eager to learn. She's fluent in English. I'm very non-fluent in Spanish. She humors me and lets me try my Spanish out on her at times. And then we revert to English so we can actually communicate. But it's been a great experience with having her. And I would, thus far, would certainly recommend it and realize why others had been recommending it to me.
I've had a lot of people recommend it. And, you know, I tried a virtual assistant American, but this was, you know, a couple of years ago. And I found, I think it was a little bit my fault. I would get so busy that I did not have enough repetitive work at the time or tasks to hand off. And it didn't seem to work. And my sense is that I think I can make it work better now. That's why I'm sort of looking at it. But also, I suspect you get better at it over time. You're gonna figure out how to better use the VA over time.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, and certainly it's very cost effective. So even if there are some growing pains associated with it in the time and maybe not fully utilized at first, I mean, I still think at the end of the day, it's worth the investment in training them up. We had done not even a virtual assistant, a virtual receptionist on Fridays so that we could have a no phone day. This was several years ago. And we, like you said, you've tried it out before and didn't really work. We found that didn't really work, having someone client facing who didn't really know us. And we didn't give them the opportunity to know us because we just wanted one day a week. Well, you know, how much time are they going to devote to getting to know our practice and things? So I think it's definitely worthwhile to just figure out what is or isn't going to work from you. And there are a lot of experiments when it comes to business development. So just chalk it up.
I'll have to check back in with you on this a year or two from now. I hear some people that have two or three virtual assistants for themselves and not for their other team members. Thinking, wow, they are busy, whatever they're doing.
I'd like to figure out how to make the personal assistant work virtually, but I haven't figured that out yet. Haven't figured out how they can, you know, drive carpool from El Salvador.
Yeah, pick up the kids from school. So yeah, let's go back to elder law. So you mentioned some of the areas you cover, and I've talked to a number of elder lawyers over the years, and it is a big category, and it can mean different things to different people, I think. At least that's my understanding. You mentioned you do some estate planning, but it's really geared to elderly, maybe. I mean, do you do estate planning also, or is it very specialized as part of your practice?
We do, you know, straightforward estate planning. One of my associates refers to it as the vanilla estate planning, and we certainly do that. And we end up with that a lot of times after we work, in particular, like with a financial advisor who had a client with an elder law need, was pleased with our service and says, hey, will you do this for people who, you know, don't have elder law or special needs? And certainly we will. And we do. It's not a huge part of our practice. One thing we don't do is like taxable estate planning, family partnerships, LLCs, like that sort of thing. We do not dip our toe into that water. But we very often do work with, because especially the special needs issues occur across the board. Whether you've got millions of dollars or barely two pennies to rub together, you might have a loved one with special needs in your life. So even if we're not involved in the higher end estate planning, we will still take on the special needs piece and work in conjunction with that estate planning attorney, who actually is estate planning attorneys are a huge referral source for us. So we do some of that straightforward planning, but typically it's more in the arena of, okay, we have a child with a disability. How can we set up this inheritance first off so we don't mess up benefits, and then so that someone is managing it for them and overseeing it and keeping them safe, whether that's a family member, professional, combination of the two. So that's a lot of the planning on the special needs side. There's a natural overlap between special needs and elder law, and that's the Medicaid component. Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about long-term care for seniors, that's when we're looking at Medicaid eligibility. But there are about 30 different Medicaid programs in Georgia, and it's that same overarching Medicaid that covers younger individuals who have disabilities. So because of that, you know, elder law is kind of what started out. It's like, okay, there's this new thing called elder law attorneys, came about in like the 1980s. And then special needs kind of branched off of that because there was so much overlap with that Medicaid component.
Yeah, it seems, you know, I think, at least when I used to think about elder law, it's, you know, we've got older people that are probably going to have care of some sort, and we're going to try to protect their assets as much as possible. That's how mm-hmm. I sort of always viewed it. But it sounds like the special needs, and so that's sort of going up to the elder person. But you're talking more about going down to their, I guess, grown kids that may have problems or issues that they need to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. So it sort of goes both ways.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes we have the same, you know, the same family that has both issues. If we've got seniors who have an adult child who's been living with them for the past 50 years, and now all of a sudden they're 85 and can't provide the care that they used to be able to, that's when we really love to get in there as far as, and I think what distinguishes our practice from others is it's not just drafting the trust. Like, we've got the resources to say, okay, what is the long-term plan here? And, you know, when you can't, not if, but when you can't care for your child anymore, or when you are deceased, what's the plan? And that's when we can connect them with community resources. And sure, getting the trust is part of that. But I always like to tell people, you know, the trust will be great one day, but I want to make your life better now. So what can, you know, who can I connect you with? What resources do we need to do? What documentation do we need to get in place so that things are better?
Yeah.
Not in the long term, but now.
I imagine that's a pretty emotional process for a parent. I mean, I'm a parent. My kids aren't, I'm not to that age yet, but, you know, I imagine you never lose that feeling, and to think you're going to be gone and you want to make sure they're taken care of, that's probably pretty tough. But so.
Yes, it is. And it's good. And it's, and that's why I feel like it's so important to not just ask the question and have them go, oh my gosh, you know, but to have resources to guide them along that, to make it a little, never less emotional, but more feeling more controlled and more deliberate in the planning.
So I guess the client journey is really important. How you take your clients through the process is a big component that's not really law, sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. We always, in elder law, CLEs and everything, you know, there are typically care managers that are presenting, there are psychologists that are presenting there, because we need to know that stuff. We're definitely part social worker in our practice.
So dig a little more into this. So do you charge hourly, flat fee, both? How do you sort of approach that?
That's some other Kool-Aid that I eventually drank, which was moving to flat fees. That had been recommended to me for years. And for the most part, we do flat fees. Now we do a flat fee initial consultation. Oftentimes that initial consultation gets credited back toward work that they do going forward. But, you know, a flat fee consultation, as well as then flat fee on estate planning documents, guardianships, probates, all of that. So we, you know, through lots of tracking and metrics, have been able to kind of determine what makes sense and have made our lives significantly easier by billing on flat fees, I would say.
And your client base, is it the sort of thing that you have recurring clients, or is it a one and done sort of thing? Is it they come in, they do, you plan for them, do whatever you're doing, and then you never see them again? Or is it the sort of thing that periodically they're going to come back with different needs? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, it's definitely recurring, but at the same time, it's transactional. So those recurrences may be, you know, 5, 10. As I get up in my years of practice, it's like, oh my gosh, was that 20 years ago that I met with you? And so it is, because these, you know, the nature of this work is, you used the word, it's a journey. And so it starts, we've had clients come in as soon as, you know, they are pregnant and had just found out that their child is going to have a disability and need to do this planning. Well, on the special needs side of things, the journey kind of is the initial setup. There are some benefits that are in play from the child being age 0 to 3. Those benefits change between age 3 and 18. Then at age 18, we're often looking at getting, you know, long-term benefits like SSI benefits. And also we need to address guardianship or potentially powers of attorney, depending on what the nature of the disability is and what the child is capable of understanding. Guardianship's not always the immediate and only answer. Then, of course, through the years, people change their mind on who it is they want to serve as the trustee, who their go-to people are. Gosh, those were our best friends back then, but now they've moved and we don't really see them anymore. And it doesn't make sense for them to be the guardian. And, you know, and that's true with any family, but in particular with a child with special needs, because you're not just planning for, okay, who's going to cover us for these 18 years? You're planning for who's going to cover us for these 70 years of the child's life. So that's a journey on the special needs side of things, because things are constantly changing, as well as on the elder law side of things. Certainly some people are just coming in on the front end. It'll crack me up. A lot of my very active senior clients come in and they're like, well, I'm 65. I must be an elder. I need an elder law attorney. And so the good thing at that point is, because one of the things that does differentiate kind of elder law documents is under a power of attorney, under a trust, we're going to consider things that other estate planners might not, and that we're looking at, gosh, what if we need to set up a trust for purposes of Medicaid or need to do it? So we can build in that language even for the perfectly healthy 65-year-old, and then can journey along with them if a diagnosis comes, one of the spouses passes away, you know, or there's a sudden health event. So definitely a journey, and the engagements are transactional but recurring.
So you've been in this practice area for a good number of years. You know, just looking at the demographics, I imagine this is a growing area. I mean, you said it sort of became a thing in the 80s, maybe, elder law, but what have you seen? What kind of growth have you seen, generally speaking?
Well, I think the most obvious one that everyone thinks of is, oh my gosh, the boomers. You must have so much business with the boomers. And that's very true. And certainly the demographics are working in our favor for the time being. But also there's just increased awareness around the fact that people like me exist. And that awareness, I would say, has come from the senior services industry in general that has sprung up. You know, I love connecting clients with care managers, aging life specialists. They used to be called geriatric care managers, but nobody likes the word geriatric anymore. So now they're aging life specialists. And so these are people who, one of them has a tagline that I love that says, I let a daughter be a daughter. So that daughter can go to lunch and get nails done and go to the theater and go shopping and, you know, go to the park and Braves games and the kind of things that a daughter would like to do in lieu of scheduling doctor's appointments, picking up prescriptions, you know. So there, this whole industry has sprung up in particular because families are more spread out now. Everyone doesn't live in the same town forever and ever, amen. So these care managers can step in and really be boots on the ground, whether your family's here or not. And so those care managers are just an example of the kind of industries that have sprung up. And then those care managers know how important a power of attorney is, or how important a trust is, or what are your long-term plans, or those care managers need authority to talk to your children, you know, and share information. So that's one example of, even besides demographics, just awareness around seniors and aging issues is rising. And the same, there are also more people living in community, like senior communities. So word spreads there. There are also brokers essentially who work with people locating the appropriate assisted living or the appropriate independent living. So by being in relationship with all those people, which is a lot of what my director of marketing does, goes to the senior care network events and the senior fairs and meets these people, that allows us to provide these resources to our clients, but also serves as a source of business for this ever-growing area. And the same sort of industry is rising up more so now around the special needs population, where we've got, you know, different support groups and different living facilities and schools. You know, schools are really becoming aware and doing what they call transition fairs for kids who have disabilities can potentially stay in the school system until age 22. And then it's kind of like getting pushed off a cliff. And so the schools are really having people come in and talk about some of these things. So, you know, sure, the demographics are in our favor, but I think just the general awareness, which is wonderful all around, is helping keep our pipelines full as well.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit. Sort of a two-part question. What led you to become a lawyer? Why'd you become a lawyer? And then what put you on the path to do what you do now, the elder law practice area?
I always feel like I should never answer that question, what caused me to become a lawyer, because it's not the most scholastic of endeavors. It wasn't, I've always wanted to help people and pursue justice or that type of thing, if I'm truly honest. It was a combination of LA Law, which I'm dating myself saying that, but I loved that show. Then also it was a combination of accidentally graduating early from college and none of my friends were looking for jobs yet. And it was like, what should I do? You know, it seemed like a really good idea to study abroad for a whole year at the time and earn those extra credits until it came time to graduate. And then I was like, well, gosh, what am I going to do with my life? And also I've always been, you know, as compared to math, a lot better at reading, writing, history, those types of things. And so I really did think, in addition to it being a respected position, and I knew I wanted to, you know, have a good career ahead of me. So law just kind of made sense in that regard. And then there was also the pillow that my mother cross-stitched for me that was sitting on my bed from, you know, elementary school on that said, don't marry a doctor or lawyer, be one. So she'll tell you that's why.
Nice. So you're an elder lawyer now, but did you start out in that practice area or did you do something else and shift into that?
So I majored in international business undergrad, and so then decided, okay, well, I'll practice international law. So I went to law school at Tulane in New Orleans, 3 years trying to study in New Orleans, which was not the easiest thing to do. But after taking a couple classes in international law, I kind of thought, yeah, this isn't really clicking with me. I'm more like people and, you know, that type of thing. So then I thought I wanted to do family law. Those classes interested me. Always a lot of drama, interesting cases to read as far as what was going on. But strife is not really my thing. So that was not going to be a good fit for me. And then my other credit that I need to give here is Anna Nicole Smith, because that was going on when I was in law school, all the Pearson Marshall v. Marshall and all that sort of stuff. So my trust and estates class was very much in real time and made it seem all the more interesting. So I enjoyed that. And really that's kind of how I honed in on estate planning, trust and estates.
So you started estate planning generally, and then you moved to the elder.
Yep, I did. I worked one summer for an attorney who did elder and special needs law and thought, okay, yeah, I like this. And then kind of found that I was good with that population. I didn't really know. I had always hung around seniors. My mother was a minister with older adults. And before that, she taught at what was then called the DeKalb County Mental Retardation Center, which you would never call it now. And so she had been a teacher for kids with special needs. So I'd been around those populations my whole life and realizing that, oh my gosh, there's back to that whole awareness thing. I didn't even know. I didn't have any elder law classes in law school. They didn't exist. And so finding just that mesh of things was a really great fit.
You mentioned Tulane. You know, Mardi Gras is coming up here on Tuesday. So
it is. Yeah. I got a friend of mine posted, look for me on the float, third rider from the back, bottom row. And I was like, I'll be at work.
Yeah, I grew up in Mobile, which is, you know, we had Mardi Gras too. I take my kids back every now and then. They're trying to get me to take them this weekend. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. But
oh, come on, Dad.
I know. Yeah.
What will you remember, Mardi Gras or
editing
the podcast?
Exactly. All right, so let's fast forward. So eventually you started your own firm, and it sounds like you did that alone for a while. When you started it, well, let me back up. Did you know you always wanted to start a firm? And then when you started it, you know, how'd you know you were ready? Or did you know?
I didn't. So it was, you know, I kind of had a back and forth with it initially. So I had always just worked in small firms before that and always thought I would just kind of have this natural progression up the corporate ladder and eventually would become a partner. That's kind of what I had just envisioned. But when it kind of tied in with my personal life, I think as of these big types of decisions always do, as my daughter was born, so that was 2007, when she was born, and I thought I wanted more control and flexibility over my schedule. And so I thought, you know, what better to do with a newborn than start a law firm? You know, that was an interesting choice, but I did. So I was on my own for about 3 years. My son was born in 2010. And then after he was born, I thought, okay, I need to get rid of this managing the law side of things or managing the firm side of things and go back to just being a lawyer. So I did that for a while. And then once I kind of had my bearings, thought, okay, let me try this again. I think at the end of the day, a lot of people, regardless of the industry, law or not, just think I want to be the, for me, it wasn't so much in control. It was more about, you know, flexibility and just being able to do what I needed to do when I wanted to do it, how I wanted to do it. So I wouldn't say it was ever an intentional thing. A lot of encouragement from my husband to do it because I didn't vision myself that way, but now I can't see any other way.
You know, that's interesting. Kids discussion, you know, right or wrong, you know, mothers take a larger role in kids' lives typically. And so it's, you know, as when people start firms, sometimes the analysis is, am I going to be able to take care of everybody? It sounds like with you, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you thought about that, but part of it was, hey, I want to be able to take care of everybody. So I want the freedom, the flexibility, and I'm really only going to get that if I'm the boss or if it's mine. Is that, mm-hmm. Sounds like that sort of went into your thinking.
Yeah, very much so. And I think I was a little delusional about it too. Like I said, especially starting, because I am the primary earner for our family. So thinking I'm going to start my own firm and, you know, all this, where my household is very equal as far as responsibilities for kids. So that made it a lot better. My husband actually works here at the firm now. So a family business for sure. But yeah, definitely it's a puzzle piece and you just move stuff around and shift it as you need to.
So, okay. So you started a firm, then you maybe went somewhere else, then you went back to have your firm. And then eventually you said you had a partner join. Tell mm-hmm. us about how that went down. And
yeah, so
we'll dig into that a little bit.
Yeah. So it was 2013 when I went out on my own, August of 2013. And I got a call, I think like November or December of 2013 from Mark Biernath, my future partner. And he had been trying to track me down at my old firm and didn't realize I had left and called and said, why didn't you tell me you were leaving? I've been looking for a partner. I'm like, well, I didn't know I had to, you know, get your permission or discuss it with you first. And so he said, well, let's talk. And I honestly said to him, I said, I'm just getting my bearings here. I just had paid a fortune for a phone system back in the day and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, no, I'm not really going to be interested because you just come to lunch. So we went to lunch, we talked, we had a lot of, you know, synthesis with what we were, you know, looking for in our practices. So it just made sense. I guess he strong armed me, but it was probably one of the best business decisions I ever made. So can't complain about it, but it certainly was not something that I thought was going to come out of that lunch.
And so how did you manage from being on your own and you being the boss to then having a partner? How did you sort through those dynamics?
I think we were very aligned in what we wanted. And I don't think you have to be aligned in what you want individually for a partnership, but we were very upfront about it. And it just so happened that we were aligned. Mark had a lot going on in his personal life as far as he had a wife with disabilities and he was her caregiver. So he had a lot going on there. I had my, you know, young family that I was, you know, interested in being very involved with. And so both of us were aligned, but even if we hadn't been, I think as long as we were upfront, it's a lot about just setting those expectations with this person who is your equal slash boss who you're accountable to, who it's very easy for resentments to build up with. We never had any of that. And I think a lot of it was just because we were so upfront and aligned about it going in. You know, if he had wanted to work 80 hours a week, that would have been fine. We just would have drafted our, you know, fee splits and things differently based on that. But it worked. I just think, like so many things, marriage, whatever else, communication is going to be the key to that. Mm-hmm.
At the law firm GC, our team of experienced attorneys provides knowledgeable legal counsel for businesses of all sizes. Founded by Jonathan Hawkins, our firm specializes in corporate law, real estate, litigation, and more. To learn how we can become your trusted legal advisors, visit www.yourlawfirmgc.com and schedule a free consultation today. The law firm GC. Law done right.
I think, you know, people ask me a lot about forming new partnerships. What's important? And I think, you know, communication, you just mentioned, setting expectations is huge. For anybody else out there who may be thinking about forming a partnership, any other words of wisdom or advice that you would give them as they are exploring that?
I think it would be, Mark and I did work on some cases together at first, you know, co-counseled on some things. I think that was key to seeing how the others, you know, the other of us worked. I am hoping within the year to bring one of my associates, and I are already in discussions about, you know, partnership. And I think having worked with someone now for 26 years, you know, that's kind of an ideal if you can. And I do believe in kind of promoting from within. I feel like that's a lot less scary than just signing up blind with somebody. When I think back on what I did with Mark, it's like, wow, that was gutsy, more gutsy than I realized at the time. So I would encourage people to think about it that way. I haven't done it yet, but I think it's going to work.
Yeah. All right.
Jonathan's going to make it so it works.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. So it sounds like at some point your partner passed away and then it's just you again.
Yep. So since 2018, well, he had to retire in 2018, passed away in 2021. And, but yes, so since 2018, I guess Nadler Biernath is really just Nadler, but, you know, hold on to that name as a tribute to my good friend and partner.
Yeah, that's nice. So let's talk about what a typical work week looks for you nowadays. You're the CEO, I guess, the owner. You've got a couple associates. How much of your work week is, you know, operations, administration, marketing, and client work, those kind of pieces? How do you manage all that?
My hand in the business piece is getting a lot smaller by intention. I was overwhelmed with a lot of the business side of things, trying to do everything myself, not having systems in place. You know, as someone who doesn't even know how to work Excel, you know, I'm not the best person to be tracking KPIs. So I have intentionally stepped back from a lot of that, in particular with our most recent hire, which was the practice manager. You know, up until I had more help with those sort of things, I was trying to keep it to one day a week of nothing but firm stuff. Really, it had to be 2 days a week of nothing but firm stuff, which really doesn't number on your productivity as far as your clients are concerned. They don't really care if your IELTS account is balanced. So just trying to strike that balance has been, I think always will be, a consummate struggle for me. But I feel like if I did have any pearl of wisdom to pass on to people, it's get the help, stick to what you're good at. And, you know, I now just review reports that were created and talk about them. And it's just, it's changed the way everything runs around here. Once it got to that point, it's one of those things you wish you had done it sooner.
Always. Well, I think it's important what you just said, that a lot of lawyers, they think, you know, some don't want to do the legal work. They want to do the business side. Some want to do the trial work and they don't want to do anything else. But I think to your point, it's very important to know what you're good at, know what you like, and do what you like and what you're good at, and get other people to do the things that perhaps or feel like a time suck for you.
Yeah.
You get someone else to make the reports and you review them. That's perfect, right?
And it's amazing how fast they can spit them out. It takes me, you know, it's like, oh, really? No wonder I was so overwhelmed with trying to get this done. It's only supposed to take 5 minutes, and it was taking me, you know, an hour and a half.
Yeah, that I've mentioned this many times, but that's how I feel about new law firm owners and bookkeeping. They always, very often, they go out and they say, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do everything. I can't afford it. And then they spend 15, 20, maybe more hours a month trying to figure out QuickBooks and reconciling this and doing all that, when really you could have spent that time marketing or doing client work and have somebody else do it for a cheaper rate, and then you could review it. And so I always recommend, if you're starting your firm, first thing you should do, get an outsourced bookkeeper. Just do it. There are plenty of them out there. It's money well spent. So
I agree.
So now you've been at it, you've had a partner, you've been on your own, you're back on your own. What would you say is your favorite or the best part of running your law practice?
I think my favorite part is, I think I would have said it's just the law, you know, getting to, I guess maybe not running my law practice is my favorite part. You know, getting back to the point, I really feel like I have hit a groove and a sweet spot at this point in time where I am just able to focus on the law. But then as far as, you know, being my own boss and how that works, obviously just the flexibility, you know, I can't believe I've got one going to college in 2 years and one, you know, it's just crazy that, you know, where you find yourself, and I've got this flexibility to do what I need to do when I need to do it. Might there be some late nights associated sometime? Yeah, but I can do that because I didn't have to be somewhere 9 to 5.
Okay, so flip that question. What's the worst part? What do you hate the most or like the least?
One of my least favorite things is the HR aspect of things. I would say absolutely my least favorite stuff is what I'm enjoying being out of right now, which is the year-end payroll census and renewing the insurance and all that sort of stuff, which really shouldn't be part to our point about, you know, you need to leverage what you can do. So that was my least favorite part, but I'm glad to have gotten that off my plate for the most part, other than having to pay the bills.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier your husband is now involved with the firm. What's that like, working with your husband?
Yeah, it works great for us. And I realize it might not for some people. I talk to people, and it seems like people who know it doesn't work haven't necessarily tried it. I guess you don't know till you try it, but we've made it work. He and I don't necessarily interact a ton. And so I have no doubt that's a key to part of it as well. I feel sorry for our children because there is a lot of business talk. I think neither one of them is going to ever want to even consider for a millisecond being a lawyer because we talk about it. But, you know, we do still manage to set it aside when it's time to. But it's been great as far as having someone without having a partner. It's almost like he obviously has a very vested interest in the firm and sees things from different perspectives as well, having more interaction with the staff. So it's been really great. Just despite we both had hesitancies about it, and we very much went into it as a, let's just try this and see what happens. But it's been 2.5 years now. So
that's great. That's great. So, okay, let's shift gears again. A big topic I talk to a lot of lawyers about and I hear about a lot is people selling their law firms. I don't think you are actively considering that, but I believe you've at least pursued buying a law firm, or maybe you've pursued other opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, take us through maybe your thinking on that front. Is that something you, obviously, I think you were interested in at least at some point, and are you still interested in that?
Yeah, so I'm very open-minded to it. I can see maybe it's my business degree background. You know, it's an opportunity, and why just slam the door and say no way? I've certainly gotten calls from attorneys over the years or brokers saying, hey, we're looking to sell this, would you be interested? And a lot of times I've said yes, and that's the last I ever hear of it. So I don't know, but you know, I'm not going to say no. I would certainly investigate any opportunity. Most recently, a colleague and I had looked into purchasing one and gotten pretty far down the road with it. It is a lot. It was extremely time consuming to try and do our due diligence and figure out what we wanted out of the firm, what we wanted to buy, what our vision for the firm would be if it did become ours, and interactions with the sellers and all that. And at the end of the day, it just turned out that the sellers weren't quite as ready as they thought they were. It wasn't a matter of money. It wasn't some of the things that you think would typically cause a business transaction to not work out. It was more probably, I guess, an emotional or a readiness issue. And so it didn't work out. But I would certainly still be, again, I'm never going to say no to an inquiry. I might ask three questions and then say, no, I'm out. But you know, I think it's great. I think it's really great the way the business of law has evolved. I think, you know, a lot of people just kind of thought, okay, you practice for years and then you say, okay, I'm 70. I don't want to do this anymore. Who do I trust to give my clients their name and just hand it off and walk away? And that's not at all the way things have to work, which I think is very encouraging for lawyers. It also changes. One of the things I learned through that process is, you know, it gets your mind turning like, well, what would I have to do to make my practice saleable? And so it definitely has changed some of the practice that we have around here, systematizing things, tracking things, having good data, just for when that time does come. You know, as I see it now, I think mine would probably just be a gradual sell off to my associate, soon to be partner, who is younger than I am. So that's what I envision, but you never know. And obviously having things in a saleable condition, it's an exciting opportunity for lawyers these days, I think.
There's a lot of things you said there that I'd like to highlight. I think it's great. I think number one, being open to it. I think more lawyers should be open to it. I think there are lots of opportunities out there, sort of like the growth of the elder law practice. I think that there's an aging population of lawyers out there that may not have internal attorneys or partners to transition to, and they're either just going to walk out and turn the lights out, or perhaps they can find a place to transition it to an existing external firm like yours. The other point that I think is interesting is all the work and due diligence that goes into it, and then it may not happen. I think this happens a lot in the non-legal, just business world. There are a lot of transactions and M&As that, you know, mergers that are explored, and they go pretty far down the line, and then they don't go all the way. I've known just from non-lawyer friends that own businesses, you know, they think, oh, this is it. I'm about to sell it. I'm about to cash out and walk out, and then something always happens. And they've been through the process 3 or 4 times until they finally get it done. So, you know, buying a firm, it's not easy. And I think, you know, it's good to go through the due diligence. Maybe, I don't know, you know, don't tell us anything, any secrets, but, you know, maybe talk us through a little bit through the due diligence process and what you learned going mm-hmm. through that.
Yeah. So as far as I learned, it's very interesting to look at someone else's books and see how they track things and or don't track things, and trying to really get an idea. Very interesting to go through the valuation process. We did have, you know, an outside person, of course, do the valuation for us and determine what the value of the firm is. Very interesting to me was, you know, it's not like you have to, you know, cut a check for $1 million and hand it over the day of closing, you know, phasing out and just the multitude. It, in a lot of ways, it reminded me of drafting a trust in a sense, because when clients say, can you do this? I'm like, yeah, a trust can do anything that you want it to do within reason, but you got to decide what that is and decide, you know, what the manner is going to be. Is there going to be an earn out? Is there going to be a lump sum settlement? Like just things that I had not had any exposure to. So it was definitely learning a lot. And I do feel like maybe it's a good thing that one didn't work out, because I'm so much more educated now going into the next one. So, but just the time consuming aspect of it. I mean, because we had even gotten into underwriting and dealing with all of our financials and things like that. And it was a beast shopping around the loans. And it was like a mortgage times a million, you know, trying to get, especially coming from underwriting for me and my colleague, it was, you know, all of it was a lot.
That's interesting, your point about learning a lot, and maybe you're better for this not being the one. It's the old adage, you know, a lot of the plaintiff's attorneys, they say, you know, you make the money on the cases you turn down, not the ones you keep. The other component I think is important is, and this is both for sellers and you experience as a buyer, it's the emotional piece. A lot of lawyers, this is their identity and they can't let it go. It's their, you know, their practice, everything they've built, and it's hard for them to let that go. So that's another piece, as you know, folks are out there maybe thinking about buying a practice. You got to keep that in mind.
Yep, and I totally get it.
Yeah.
I can see where that plays in.
So shifting again, what's, as we sit here today, what's your long-term vision for your firm?
Well, immediate, I've kind of already alluded to, want to bring on a partner. As far as, you know, our practice areas, I want to keep the same elder and special needs. Definitely, there's this other interesting piece of special needs that I find particularly interesting that I am focusing my practice on, which, and you mentioned PI attorneys, and it's actually an overlap with that, which is, you know, a lot of times a personal injury attorney will get this great big settlement, but it just so happens it's for a person who is profoundly disabled now. And so they often, you know, the person doesn't have capacity to agree to the settlement on their own. So they have to get a conservator appointed or have to go through the trial court and need to get funds placed into a trust, potentially a special needs trust. So there's a lot of work that goes on in the settlement planning side of things. And personally, I just find that very interesting. And I really like working with other attorneys on that. And also, I mean, you get involved with trustees and settlement planners and all that. So I really like the opportunities there. So for me personally, I'm looking to grow that part of our business. As far as growth personnel wise, I do recognize that when I bring on a partner, they're probably going to want another associate or maybe a very high level trained paralegal. So I think we will experience some more growth, even though I've had a lot of growth over the past few years and kind of would like to swear it off for a bit. That doesn't seem to be in the cards. So I think more growth. I do not envision ever getting to a point where there are multiple offices. Again, never say never, especially with an acquisition or something that could happen. But, you know, we have a good rapport here in the office. And though not everyone has to come in all the time, I like kind of having everyone together. I think we all thrive off of the combined team environment. So I don't necessarily see multiple locations in the future, but I will see, you know, personnel growth, I think, and probably a change of office space because we're kind of busting at the gills here.
So your practice, is it state specific or is there a federal element to it?
So Medicaid is a federal program. But each little state is its own kingdom. That's the way I apply it to clients. So, and in some ways, Georgia is a very favorable place to be with elder law planning. Georgia is pretty favorable as far as, you know, the way certain assets are treated, in particular, like retirement accounts are exempt. So that takes a big chunk out of folks' net worth when it comes to determining Medicaid eligibility. So in some ways, Georgia is favorable. In other ways, it's not. Availability of resources is one. Georgia is starting, you know, traditionally it's been if you're a senior and you need nursing or you need long-term care and you need Medicaid to help pay for it, well, then it's got to be in a nursing home because that's all that Medicaid pays for seniors. That is changing. Funding has increased for in-home services. So Georgia's getting a little bit more favorable in that way. But, you know, our consultations might be with a family who says, okay, mom's in New York and she's either going to come to Georgia or she's going to come to Texas. That's a valid inquiry. You need to meet with both because even though Medicaid's a federal program, the states have their own little twists on things.
You know, you bring up a good point there. I've been involved a little bit in senior housing, and what we see or what we've seen there is typically, you know, somebody grew up in Michigan, but they live in Atlanta now, let's say. And when it's time to put mom into some sort of care home or whatever, they don't transfer her out of her house up in Michigan. They bring her down where they are, you know, down to Georgia. Not always, but a lot of times. And, you know, the population of Georgia is just growing. People are moving here. And so that's another growth, a reason for growth, I would imagine, for you. Do you see people here bringing their parents from wherever they are? You say
absolutely.
That a lot?
Yeah. Including myself.
There you go.
Just did it earlier this year. It was just from Savannah, so it wasn't that far. But yes, absolutely. And my, you know, parents have said in where they're living, no one's from here. Everyone's here because their kids are here.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Yeah. So, and that's a lot of times who we work with is, sure, we're serving the senior, but especially if that senior has already lost capacity and we're operating under a power of attorney, very often, you know, I'm really to the point now in my career where I'm working with my peers. You know, my parents are in their 80s. When I started this 20 years ago, you know, I was working with people still late 40s, not 50. Late 40s, who, you know, so I was working with people who are older than me. So it's also been kind of a fun transition in my practice that now I am working more with my peers because it's we're the ones now that have the parents are that age, which is very different than when I was 25.
Yeah. So, you know, you've grown your firm, you've been doing it for a while, you got two associates, you may add to that, you've got a lot of staff. What are some of the big challenges that you've encountered as you've grown and as you continue to grow?
I'd say the biggest challenge that I have always had, whether it was a one-man show, whether it was the nine-man show that we currently are, is balancing the workflow. Because we are transactional, it's important to get the call, book the appointment, get the person in, and get the transaction started. We're a volume business, but trying to control that volume to the point where we still are providing excellent service, timeliness. That's one of the things that we have worked on very hard to systematize as far as, you know, when clients come in, we meet with them, we tell them when they're, we now have learned, we meet with them, we tell them, okay, your drafts are going to be ready on this date. We're going to send them to you. We're going to review them on this date. We're going to sign them on this date. Going ahead and getting everything lined up helps, but it's still hard to know. And we're tracking the metrics, and it's very much a work in progress. How many clients should come in order for us to be able to support? What staff do we need to support that volume and to get the work done in a timely manner? And I don't know if that's always just going to be a thing, but I can tell you, like I said, it whether I was a one-person show or a nine-person show, it persists. So that's my biggest challenge for sure.
Yeah, a big challenge I see personally and others. It's investing the resources, you know, time, energy, money, whatever, at the right place at the right time. You know, on one level, you got to go get work. You got to go figure out how to bring a lot of work in. And then all of a sudden it's all there. Then you got to figure out how to get it done. And then how do you balance all that? And then you're like, okay, is it time to hire somebody else? It's a challenge, but you know, that's what I like. That's the fun part for me, at least. It's a puzzle mm-hmm. we're trying to solve.
Okay, good. Well, come on over and solve it. Let me know once you have that formula worked out.
I know. Well, cool. One other question. So sometimes it's a hard question, but if you were not practicing law, what would you be doing?
Do I have to realistically be supporting myself?
Either way.
I'll give you two in. Yeah, so I think realistically, if I actually had to, you know, support myself, I would probably see myself in... I think when I got out of college, had I not gone the law school route, I would have gone the consultant route. I would have been with, you know, Ernst & Young or Deloitte or, you know, whoever it was, Accenture, or whoever it was at that point in time. So I think I would be doing that. That's what I would like to do. I think as a mother, it probably wouldn't be the most realistic, but I really thought it was cool when all my friends were jet setting around working in this office this week and this office that week. And they were definitely supporting themselves. So I think maybe consultant of some sort would be a good realistic job. If I didn't have to eat, I would own a plant store. My COVID, I call it a hobby, my family calls it obsession, was houseplants. And so I have gotten very into houseplants. I have a log book. I have a fertilizing schedule. The living room is no longer called the living room. It's called the plant room. There are lamps everywhere, which is a challenge to make it still look decent and not look like you've got grow lights everywhere. But so that I would absolutely, and I still kind of hold out hope maybe one day that I can have a little plant boutique.
That's cool. So you're living in a jungle inside the house, or you're building one?
I do. Yes.
That's awesome.
Our next house will have a conservatory. I've already laid that ground rule.
Hey, that's awesome. Well, cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. If people want to find you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
So the best way to get a hold of me would be either to call the office, the 770-455-0535, or via email. And it's just my name, heather@nadlerbiernath.com.
And we'll put that in the show notes because make sure people spell it the right way. So,
yes.
Well, awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Founding Partner Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. You can also connect with Jonathan on LinkedIn and check out the show notes with links to resources mentioned throughout our discussion by visiting www.yourlawfirmgc.com. We'll see you next time for more origin stories and insights from successful law firm founders.